listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. Grassroots community solar-powered radio. And it's a sunny solar day here in Fairfield, Iowa.
Yes, it is. Beautiful day.
And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mommy, Caroline Kilborn. I don't usually call you that, do I?
No. You know, it'd be nice if it would stay like this and then turn off nice for spring, right?
This is we had our January thaw, and then we got hit again, and this is the reprieve before winter's last gasp.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. But yeah. I can hope.
Yeah. Yep. Well, since we were last on the air...
It's been a while.
Cheryl Fusco-Johnson filled in so beautifully for us the last couple of weeks with some really interesting guests. If you didn't get a chance to hear those interviews, you can check them out on the KRUUFM website or writersvoices.com, where we post all of our interviews. And today we have a really fascinating guest.
We do. I've been reading this book. It's one of those books. There's so much in it that you have to read a little bit and then digest it, and then read a little more. And the characters are so vivid, and the storyteller, of course, is a young girl, and it's just great. And it's written by Mary Ellen Stefaniak.
Mary Helen Stefaniak.
And she teaches at Creighton University and lives in Omaha and Iowa City as well. She's the author of The Turk and My Mother, another great book. And let's see if there's some more things here. She grew up around Midgetville, Georgia. And this is a book about the South. And it's in the days when the schools were separate but equal, supposedly.
But not.
But, you know, the way, I mean, it's... It embraces nearly every traditional genre of Southern literature, from the madcap tall tale to the literature of moral engagement to the Gothic tragedy, drawing deeply on array of sources and influences. It unveils the oft-hidden interracial, multicultural history of the South as it plays off the historical links between coastal Georgia and Islamic West Africa through the slave trade, and the lives of Muslim slaves who could read and write Arabic.
Wow.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Mary Helen.
Well, thank you. Thanks, Monica. Glad to be here.
We're delighted to have you. And you have some connection with Fairfield, correct? You've been here before.
I do. Some years ago, I was invited to be one of the instructors in a week-long writing workshop there,
which I attended.
That's right.
It was
Well, so you have met her then.
I have met Mary Helen. Yeah.
Wow.
And I've been sort of following your career. I bought when your The Turk and My Mother came out. I bought that and read that. And then when I received this book from your publisher, I believe, and was just really excited at the opportunity to get to speak with you about it. So, Mary Helen, why did you decide to write The Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia?
Well, that sort of breaks down into two questions for me, both the question of why the Georgia part, why in Georgia, and why the connection to Baghdad. It's actually my mother grew up in Milledgeville, Georgia. You can probably tell by the way I sound that I most likely didn't grow up in Georgia. But I spent much of my childhood, every vacation of my childhood was a vacation to the Milledgeville, Macon area, you know, staying with relatives. We weren't sightseers, we were visiting relatives. And so I did have kind of an annual stay there that really makes me feel as though it's the place maybe that I know second best of all places on the earth. And then as far as the Baghdad part goes, the book really, I didn't always like to start out by saying this, but I've said it enough, I guess, that it's not a secret anymore, that the idea for the book really came to me in March 2003, when right after I had read, one morning I read in the newspaper an account of the shock and awe bombing of Baghdad, and it just, I thought about all of the things that Baghdad and that kind of the cradle of civilization that Baghdad's at the heart of there, you know, between the Tigris and the Euphrates, all of the things that that meant to us that had sort of gotten, and when I say us, I mean, you know, those of us who are kind of the inheritors of Western culture, and how all of that had kind of gotten supplanted by this kind of new relationship with Baghdad that was characterized by, or that became part of the build-up to the war in Iraq. And so I just sort of had in my mind, I didn't know how I was going to do it, but I wanted to write a novel in which Americans, and they turned out to be the people of what was then, of three-step Georgia, in middle Georgia in 1938-39, but I wanted to write a novel in which any group of Americans had a relationship with Baghdad that was different from the relationship that, you know, was developing or was prevalent in 2003. And, you know, and I wasn't just thinking of Baghdad. I was thinking of, as I said, you know, kind of that part of the world as the cradle of our civilization. So that's kind of, that's how it happened. And then my mother's family has just always been a rich source, you know, when you of story for me, and of character certainly too. So those two things came together.
I think as writers, we often have this idea that Southern families are better material than Northern families.
I wonder why that is.
Well,
I don't know. It's like
maybe, except you know, the Turk. When I the Turk and my mother kind of does a number on my father's family in Milwaukee. So.
That's true. That's true.
So I got some stories. Although they're his parents immigrated from Eastern Europe, so they were a new family there. But nevertheless, I've gotten some mileage out of my families in both places, and I've always felt particularly lucky to be this sort of, you know, product of this kind of I even called it bicultural experience of, you know, growing up in a family that had this Eastern European influence on the one hand, and then every summer, or not, well, not necessarily in the summer, but every year, got kind of immersed in the South.
I bet.
Lucky.
I'm curious how your parents met.
Yes, yes.
Or is that the next book?
Well, it could be, you know. Another, my mother and deserves to have a novel written about her and her alone. But she met my dad when he was stationed during World War II. You know, he was stationed at Robbins Field, which is outside Macon, Georgia. You know, when she and her high school friends and her sisters they would go to the USO and dance with the soldiers, and so she met my dad when she was I think she was a senior in high school. By 1945 he was actually being shipped, early in 1945 he was shipped out to the Philippines, and she went north. She got on the train and went north to live with his family in Milwaukee.
Wow.
And when she got there, it didn't quite occur, it never, I don't think it quite occurred to her that, although she knew they were from the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and a part of it that is now in Hungary, but actually is Croatian ethnically. But in any case, she had really never met a person who wasn't born in the U.S. I mean, she was from the, you know, kind of a rural, small, more rural than small town background in Georgia, and it hadn't occurred to her, I think, that they weren't going to sound like George, you know, like my dad.
Oh, wow.
Who grew up in Milwaukee. And so they had quite a...
culture shock.
Yeah, culture shock, difficulty understanding one another. They couldn't, they didn't know what she was saying. She didn't know what they were saying.
Wow.
They both thought the other spoke English in a very odd way. And I say, in a way, my mother was like an immigrant in her own land.
Wow.
And so I think she had quite a time of it, especially at first. So much so, actually, that she decided to go back to Georgia and wait until my dad came home And then she'd go up and with him join the relatives up there. But initially they just sort of, it was kind of a cultural understanding that if, well, she married this guy, then she kind of belonged in his family now, you know.
Yeah.
And so she tried to do that, but then she ended up going home and not going back to Milwaukee until my dad returned from the war. But she did work. She got a job up in Milwaukee, and she endured for quite a while.
Wow.
So as she does, she should. I could do a whole novel on Mom.
That would be interesting. It really would.
So, Mary Helen, have you ever been to Baghdad yourself?
I have never been to Baghdad. No.
Oh.
It is a place that I would like very much to visit. I wasn't in Georgia in 1938 either. But I had more direct, what can we say, like informants, you know, in my mom and her family.
I thought,
but
maybe
no, I've never been to Baghdad. I kind of got connected. The most wonderful thing that happened to me in researching this book, there were two wonderful things. Because I when I first thought, like I said, all I thought was that I was going to write this story in which a group of Americans had a, you know, different kind of relationship to Baghdad, and I kind of knew my group of Americans pretty well, but I didn't know all that much about Baghdad, and it in some ways seemed like, you know, quite a reach, right, to try to
yes.
get from Georgia
mm-hmm.
to Baghdad. And all I really had to start with was the family name Caliph, which really is a name in my mother's family. And,
oh my.
You know, that pun was there. That's all I had, was the Caliphs of Georgia and the C-A-L-I-P-H, Caliphs or Caliphs of Baghdad. Early on, I came across, so I was always looking for connections, you know. And then, of course, the Arabian Nights, I kind of latched onto that right away. But I continued to look for possible connections. And I early on, in reading about Baghdad, I came across a book called The Camel Bells of Baghdad, which was written by a physician named Janet Miller, who then has a fictional counterpart in the book. I appropriate her as the woman that for whom Miss Spivey is a traveling companion when she's a girl. And the real Janet Miller was indeed a physician from Nashville, Tennessee, and this book, The Camel Bells of Baghdad, was a travelogue. I mean, she was just writing about her travels in the Middle East, specifically in Iraq and Iran, which at that time was Persia. And but she was an amazing woman. She was like a doctor without borders in the 1920s and 30s.
Wow.
Janet Miller. She also, somebody needs to write a book about her, because I didn't find very much about her. There's nothing written about her other than that I could find, other than this book that she herself wrote that I was fortunate enough to find on the shelf.
How did you find? You actually found it at your library?
Yep.
Wow.
Yes, the book itself. And then I subsequently, it was published in 1934 by Houghton Mifflin, I think. I then found a copy on the internet, you know, to buy because I wanted it for myself.
Right.
But no, it was there on the shelf, amazing. And also a complete set of the of Sir Richard F. Burton's translation of A Thousand and One Nights, which was published in the, you know, probably in the 1890s. This was like part one of a set of, there were only 1,000 sets made. He privately published it. And these books also are on the shelf in the library at Creighton University, where I teach in Omaha.
Wow.
So I'm glad they, you know, didn't go through and clean out all those dusty books, because they certainly served me well. But anyway, so that was that's where I learned a great deal. That book was like a treasure trove of details about Baghdad and the Middle East in about 1930, which was just when I wanted my school teacher character, Miss Spivey, to have been traveling with the good doctor.
Well, you brought a lot of different threads that you wove together into this book, and you
mm-hmm.
did it really quite beautifully. And the tapestry is coherent, but you can, you know, there's just so many different things, that aspects, because you that the one you've been talking about is the connection with, you know, looking at Baghdad, Georgia from a different perspective. But then you also have the whole racial aspect of the Deep South in that time period. And you have aspects of, well, and the coastal Georgia, you know, the...
Yes.
That. So how did you learn about that part of it?
Well, that was my other big, wonderful surprise. The Camel Bells of Baghdad was one, and then I had already been working on the book for a while when I decided, for purposes of the plot, I needed one of the coastal islands. I had to set part of the book on one of the coastal islands, which I don't know. I mean, I had been to Savannah and to whatever, Skidaway Island, which is right there off Savannah, but... we decided I still make lots of trips to the south, and with my mother, my husband and my mother and I will drive down, and we were on one of those trips, and I said, well, we've got to make a side trip to Sapelo Island, was the island I decided because we should explore, because it had been it's not as developed as the other islands on the coast there. There aren't any resorts or anything. There's most of it belongs to well, a lot of it belongs to either the state of Georgia or the University of Georgia. There's a marine institute, and there's a national park, and there's all sorts of things, nature preserve. And so we went there, and we took the all-day Tuesday tour of Sapelo Island, and it's a wonderful thing. I highly recommend it if you're gonna be in Georgia. Be there on the last Tuesday of the month, and then take the tour. You need to sign up for it in advance on the internet. Although we kind of lucked into it, we didn't know about the signing up in advance, and we just kind of, there were some cancellations, so we went along. And a park ranger, first you take a boat across, it takes about 30 minutes to get to the island, and then you a park ranger takes you on a bluebird bus, and you drive right around, you know, and it's just a marvelous, marvelous thing. You see the mansion that was actually built by an automotive magnate in the 1920s, and then it belonged to R.J. Reynolds, the tobacco company guy, and then he ultimately bequeathed it to the state of Georgia. But and it's built on the foundations of, or at least more or less on the foundations of, the original plantation house on the island. And so we took that whole tour, and I thought, oh, this is great. This is where I'm going to set this certain part of the story that I thought needed to, well, that there is a part that takes place on the island, although it actually ends up taking place on Skidaway rather than Sapelo. But Sapelo Island comes into it, and we were finished with that tour, and we were back in the visitor's center, which was had a little sort of museum arrangement with historical artifacts in display cases. And while I was looking at books to see what I should buy about to find out more about the history of Sapelo Island, my husband kind of took me by the sleeve and said, look at this in this display case. And in the display case, there was a facsimile of a notebook, a little handmade notebook that was full of writing. And the writing was Arabic script.
Ooh.
I thought, what? Nobody on the tour had said anything about, I don't know, people who would be writing an Arabic script. It turned out that I didn't have to look very far at all for a connection between Georgia and Islam, which Baghdad was the center of at the time, because that notebook belonged to a slave named Bilali Mahomet, who was a West African Muslim, literate, you know, who had been kidnapped as a teenager and sold into slavery and ended up in the Americas, and he was not the only one. There were many literate Muslims among the slaves in the Caribbean and in the South.
Were there actually real camel drivers on any of these islands?
Was there actually a camel driver? No, no. That was an invention part. That was the part that I invented. There's one of the comments about the book from Jill McCorkle that I liked. Is she said it was a blend of, no, I can't find it, but something about a blend of history and imagination.
Mm.
An intricate, dazzling, oh, I like that.
Yes, yes.
a pattern of history and imagination and truth. And it's true, there's a lot of history in it, but there's also, it is a novel and the characters are imagined. Even the characters like Bilali, who then, it was like, how could I resist bringing Bilali into the book as the ancestor of one and possibly more than one of the black characters in the book, which is exactly what I did, because I was already developing this character named Theo Boykin. If we get around to reading a little bit of the book, I think I'm going to read the part about that introduces Theo Boykin. He is a black teenager who's very, very bright and is sort of being privately educated by the teacher in the colored school out in the country, but then when Miss Spivey, the school teacher, well-traveled school teacher, comes to teach in the white school in Three Steps, she soon Theo Boykin's talents for everything from set design, you know, to invention of machines come to her knowledge through Gladys Califf, the narrator, and the Califf family, who are neighbors of Theo Boykin. And she enlists him in first to make a haunted house for a Halloween party that she has for the town, and then he becomes very much involved in the Baghdad Bazaar, you know, the which is a revival of the defunct town festival as a Baghdad Bazaar. And I was already developing him as this kind of brilliant young both naturally talented and, you know, beginning to be educated black teenager, so that when I came across Bilali and found that he was in many ways similar, that he was a brilliant man. He was kidnapped, as I say, in West Africa as a teenager, and brought first to the Bahamas. He was a slave. He spent most of his life as a slave on the Bahamas, and he was marvelous at inventing things, and became the overseer of the plantation, the first plantation that he was involved with, and then when he was purchased by a man who owned most of Sapelo Island in 1803, Bilali became the overseer of that plantation too. And he was really like many other slaves. He was purchased for his knowledge and his knowledge of Sea Island cotton and the various things that the plantation owner wanted to grow, but also for his sort of inventiveness, cleverness. Mm-hmm. Good, he was good at improvising, you know. And obviously, if you were building a plantation in 1803, a person who could solve technical problems for you in extremely clever ways using the materials at hand would be a very valuable character. And so here I had sort of discovered this historical character, a real person, who was, you know, it seems like he was destined to be the ancestor of
the
character that I was creating in my book, who was so similar to him. And it was such an incredibly wonderful, serendipitous thing, not only to discover that there was a literate Muslim slave, so there was this Baghdad connection on Sapelo Island, but that he had characteristics that reminded me of the character I was in the midst of creating. So he had to become an ancestor. And he's not, you know, it's not made, we don't know, the book doesn't, the novel, it isn't really claimed that Bilali is specifically a biological ancestor of Theo Boykin, but Theo Boykin's mother's people are from that island, and nearly everybody on that island was an ancestor of one of the other, right, of Bilali's daughters. So,
if you're just tuning in, this is Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Mary Helen Stefaniak, the author of The Califs of Baghdad, Georgia, a novel. And Mary Helen is just, I'm really curious, so you found this this notebook with the Arabic writing. Were you able to actually look at that and get it translated, or how did you find out so much about that slave whose name I'm not going to try and repeat, but
Bilali.
Okay. Were there things written about him? How were you able to find out so much about him?
Well, there are some things written about him, although not very much, and they all derive, they all draw on really the same sources, which are that little notebook, and then just what is known mostly, sometimes in letters and comments from people who visited the plantation. It was the, friends of the plantation owner who visited during the time that Bilali was the overseer, which was like from 1803 to 1859. My kind of primary source of information about him was a book called Drums and Shadows, which was a project of the Georgia Writers Project, like of the Federal Writers Project, during the Great Depression. And they interviewed and took photographs of people on those coastal islands, and many of the people they spoke to were the great-great-great-granddaughters and sons of Bilali. And they had knowledge of him, of course. And so that's where a lot of the information about him came, but they didn't really know very much about his life in Africa. And that's kind of an unknown, which was a reason why I could sort of invent the boy Bilali and his father on the pilgrimage to Mecca, because they could very well have done that. So that's not known. And the notebook, I actually got to look at, turn the pages of the real notebook, which is in the library at the University of Georgia in Athens, and it has been imperfectly translated. The trouble with it is, and it seems to be sort of, some of it is kind of, sort of tenets for daily living, kind of rules for living a good life. And some of it is seems to be like a legal treatise, phrases and translations of a legal treatise that the young Bilali might have memorized, and then when he was a student, and maybe he made this notebook and was writing it down, trying to remember it, to keep himself from forgetting things. But it's the script is Arabic, but the language is partly Arabic, classical Arabic, but mostly Fulani, which is the African language he would have spoken. And so, he's writing Fulani, but in Arabic script. And so it's a contested sort of incomplete translation, mm-hmm. even after all these years.
Wow.
The notebook itself.
Well, the book, in your book, your antagonist, Mavis Davis, I found extremely interesting. Because she echoed the tenure of the time, the clan and so forth.
Yes.
But she was just a little girl.
Yeah.
Yes.
Was there anyone in particular that inspired that character?
Mavis is a creation of my own.
Yeah, and if there was an inspiration, you probably wouldn't want to say.
It's not as though I have never heard anyone espouse any of the sorts of things that Mavis, and her
mother.
And her mother, but she did evolve toward the end into...
She did. Well, she did. See, and I did try to say, I did try to cut her some slack, give her some extenuating circumstances in being raised by her mother and having seen her father, hanging in the barn. So she had some, difficult things mm-hmm. that would be hard for a child to overcome. And so that's the kind of, I think when you're in that kind of precarious situation, you're all the more vulnerable to, any kind of rhetoric that allows you to feel that you're
superior,
not helpless, you're better or somehow.
Well, they some of them must have thought, some of them thought that Miss Spivey was from outer space. although they didn't talk about outer space back then, I don't think, but she was such a character, just a wonderful character. And to think that she would be teaching in a rural school like that is just really something.
She really made some waves.
Yes, she did.
She did make some waves. And she was an exactly, selfless or, you know, extremely virtuous or anything, but she knew how to make other people, it seems to me. This is the thing that made her a good teacher, even though, you know, like, she didn't exactly follow any good solid pedagogy in her dealing, for example, with Mavis Davis, you know,
right.
She kind of got into little arguments and battles with.
She could have handled that better.
Yeah, she sure could have handled Mavis better. Yeah. As Gladys, 11-year-old Gladys knows that from the very start.
Right.
Spivey could have handled Mavis better. And then you sort of get the feeling that Mavis and Miss Spivey probably personality-wise have a lot in common. They just came from different... a different set of circumstances, Miss Spivey is. I wanted to make sure she wasn't from the north. It was very important to me that she be a southerner herself, even though because she's from Tennessee originally. But she is an extremely cosmopolitan person. She didn't grow up, you know, just in Tennessee, and so. But that was kind of important to me that she be that sort of person. Although I have to tell you, there really was a teacher that my mother used to talk about, who was her favorite teacher in a one-room school in Georgia.
Uh-huh.
And there were certain things about Miss Spivey, kind of things she did with the children, that were inspired by this real teacher.
So how fully developed were your characters before you started writing? Is that something you have to do, or does it evolve as you go? Or
that kind of... mostly evolves as I go. I have, now, with some of these characters, the Southern characters are based on, inspired by members of my mom's family, extended family. And then this Miss Spivey was sort of inspired by a kind of a school teacher who inspired great loyalty by unconventional methods among certain of her students. And so I had that. But I really do discover here and in other circumstances, in everything I write, I really do discover the characters by writing them.
Okay.
It was certainly a case in point. Theo was nothing but a name. You know, I like the name Theophilus.
Well, why don't you read us a little bit about Theo?
Yes, please
Do.
Please do.
All right, well, I'm going to read. I thought about a variety of things, but I think I'm just going to read one thing, and I think it takes about 6 minutes. Does that sound all right?
That sounds wonderful.
Okay. And this is from Chapter 3. It's when we're first introduced to Theo, and you remember I said that Miss Spivey was planning to do a Halloween party, and the Caliphs, Gladys Caliph is one of her students, 11-year-old Gladys, who's the narrator here, they tell her, well, if you're going to do a haunted house, you have to get Theo Boykin involved. And so that's, you're going to see Theo Boykin meeting Miss Spivey in this scene, or in this chapter. Theo Boykin was the smartest person in Piedmont County, and everybody knew it. Whether folks liked it or not was another matter. Theo, who was about the same age as my brother Forrest, 17, could do sums in his head better than Mrs. Bibbins' adding machine at the store. And he could read you anything he laid his hands on, even if he never saw it before in his life, without ever stumbling over a single word. One 4th of July, when the parade marshal of Piedmont County waited till the last minute to line up his post-parade program, he couldn't find but one person in Claytonville, Brennan, and Three Step combined who knew all the words to the Declaration of Independence. Theo was 10 or 11 at the time. You'd better believe a murmur went through the audience when he stepped up to the podium on the courthouse lawn in Claytonville that day. But by the time he got to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, he had the whole audience in the palm of his hand. I'm told they applauded louder and longer for Theophilus Boykin than they had for the tap dancers or the Land of Liberty tableau. He could draw, too. Miss Templeton, his teacher at the colored school out in the country, said one time that Theo was a Renaissance man, by which she meant that he could do anything he put his mind to. This led to Miss Spivey calling him Signor da Vinci later on when he was drawing up plans for the Baghdad Bazaar, beautiful sketches with numbers and arrows to show what went where. None of us knew who Signor da Vinci was until we had a lesson at school on him and Michelangelo that included the opportunity to lie on your back and paint whatever you wanted on the underside of your desk. Arms. Stand it.
Oh, gosh.
When Theo came to three-step school to see about Miss Spivey's haunted house, Force and my brother Ralford and I came with him, as did his brother, Eugene, a quiet boy who was a little younger than Theo but bigger and taller than all of us. Eugene waited outside, leaning against the trunk of the walnut tree. Miss Spivey invited him to come in, but he declined. Theo hesitated at the back of the schoolroom himself, which caused me to remember something from a long time before. When I was in the first grade, my brother Force brought Theo to school with us one time. I don't recollect why. Our teacher at the time, Miss Chandler, met us at the door and explained that even though Theo Boykin was smart as a whip, the law prohibited her from allowing him inside three-step school. She might have said that she could not permit him to get a foot in the door, but what I heard was to put his foot on the floor, which made me wonder if someone would pick him up and carry him. Could Theo come inside? Or what if we put a carpet down for him to step on? I had some idea that his feet were the problem, like ours in walnut time. I thought about pointing out to Miss Chandler in my first grade wisdom that the bottoms of Theo's feet were the lightest part of him, threat at all to her floor. I had noticed this paleness on the hands and feet of colored people only recently. In fact, it was Theo Boykin who pointed it out to me. We were all cleaning white clay off ourselves after digging some out of a hole in the Boykins' yard when Theo rubbed his palms together and said, "Well, look at here, Gladys. That white dirt bleached the color right off my hands and feet." This seemed plausible to me, especially in Piedmont County, where white dirt is abundant. His mama set me straight on the matter. She scolded him for teasing. Mm-hmm. Now, in the doorway of three-step school, Theo Boykin took off his work shoes and carried them one in each hand across the threshold. He set his two bare feet flat on the pine floor, under which crickets were singing their swan song, it being late in October. Miss Spivey, who was waiting for us, acted like it was the most natural thing in the world for Theo Boykin to step inside three-step school. "Come in," she said, "and please take a seat." But she did seem a little shy about telling him what she had in mind for the haunted house. "Well, I thought we'd hang some sheets and wet string in the half room," Miss Spivey said. "Make people walk through it in the dark." Theo paced the length of the glorified closet that constituted the half in our one-and-a-half room schoolhouse. It had no windows and no electric light and was almost completely dark. When he stood in the doorway, his white shirt and expertly patched gray pants were easier to see than the expression on his face. Miss Spivey said, "What do you think?" "Ma'am," he said, "a white sheet never fooled anybody. What you need is something moving. We can fix it so if you open the door, things drop down and slide around, ghosts swooping like they're coming to get you, like that. Spiders are good, too, and easy to fix up, and I might have time to make a skeleton if I could get some help with that. I've got a skull we could use." We all held our breath for a second when he said that. "A deer skull," he said. "They're about the right size. Skeleton's the best, Miss Spivey. Nothing scarier than a skeleton rattling its bones. Do y'all know why?" We knew just to wait, but Miss Spivey said, "Why?" "Because everybody knows they've got one of those alive inside of them," Theo said solemnly. "They've got to carry it into bed at night." Out there.
Well, thank you. That's a really good taste of the flavor of the,
you know, yeah, when you read, it's a Southern, you got your Southern accent there.
I start channeling my great aunt.
Yeah, you do. Exactly. Exactly.
And that was Mary Helen Stefaniak reading from her new book, The Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia. Now, the book is told from the point of view of Gladys Caliph, who's 11 years old. Is that
correct?
Yes. Yes. How did you choose, what made you choose her as a point of view?
Well, I mean, I knew it needed to be someone who I mean, it couldn't be Miss Spivey. You know, we couldn't get inside Miss Spivey because, like you say, she's like a creature from outer space.
Right.
We need to get to know her, you know, from the outside and try to figure her out.
Yeah.
But I did want it to be someone who had a fondness for Miss Spivey.
Mm.
And also, initially, I conceived of the story as Gladys Califf in the present, sort of telling the story, you know, in the... in the present, I guess, at a time when Baghdad has a different connotation and people are thinking of changing the name of the town back to what it used to be, which I mentioned it here, and it was Three Step, Georgia, which is also a fictional name. Although when I read this, when I read in Milledgeville, when I read in Georgia, somebody said, it's Deep Step, is it? My mother's from Deep Step. You're talking about Deep Step. And I said, yes, actually it is. So, or at least, I mean, that was... where I got the name and certain features, like the one and a half room schoolhouse. But so I had this notion of people many years later, of Gladys many years later, and her brother Forrest, and actually Mavis Davis, you know, standing up in defense. They're in their 80s now, and they're standing up in defense of Baghdad, Georgia, and what it stands for. And the way to save the town is the name, and the tradition is to tell the story. And that, of course, you find that out at the end, that Gladys has an afterword on the occasion of the 72nd annual Baghdad Bazaar. And, of course, the book tells us the story of the first one. But I had that idea from the beginning, even though it doesn't appear until the end in the book. So that made me, you know that that helped me decide on Gladys.
Well,
I knew I wanted to be one of the Califfs.
Would you say she was your favorite character, or do you have a favorite?
Do I have a favorite? You know, I think that Theo might be my favorite.
Mm.
I love Force. Love. You know, everybody.
So did everybody love Force.
And how could you not? And he actually is very, at least in appearance, more than maybe in personality, but in appearance, he's very much based on one of my mother's great uncles, whose name was Elmo, actually. Not Ford.
Well.
It was Elmo. His name didn't make it into the book. He looked a lot like, like Tyrone Power.
Mm.
Now, wow. Mary Helen, did you know where the storyline was going when you started writing, or did that develop as you wrote also?
Well, what I knew was that I wanted it to be, I knew the new school teacher was going to come to town and was going to put on this, you know, revive the town festival as a Baghdad Bazaar. And I thought, well, most of the book will just cover that school year. And I knew that things were going to go awry, because the school teacher was going to be a little on the heedless side when it came to negotiating the hazardous local terrain. And I knew that there would be this very talented black teenager who became Theo Boykin. I also thought I wanted to have a night of storytelling, which occurs, which is kind of the strangest thing the book does, I guess. There's this night of storytelling when we're all waiting to find out, you know, what's going to happen after when tragedy seems to be impending. And I knew I wanted to actually go back in time, because I knew I wanted to encompass the Civil War and the beginnings of Iraq and the First World War, and then all the way back to this book of ingenious devices in the first, when Baghdad was a center of learning in the ninth century, because that was part of my, you know, project of connecting Baghdad to really to the present, not really just to 1938, but to 2010, you know.
And you do that with the...
I knew that. That's all I knew.
So you do that with a story within the story within the story within a story. How many layers deep do we go?
I think there are five.
Did you ever get lost?
You know.
Did you ever get lost in which layer you were in when you were writing?
No, although initially I thought, I didn't know actually that I was going to do them one within the other like that. I thought that one would lead to the other, rather than, you know, the situation now is that, you know, the story, May begins the story in the schoolhouse, one of the caliphs really begins the story in the schoolhouse, and then while the story she's telling, someone inside that story tells the next story and so forth. I didn't know it was going to go like that. I was reading the 1001, I was reading, you know, in the Arabian Nights, and some of the early stories do that. Not all of the Arabian Nights is like that. It's a whole bunch of different stories, Sinbad and Aladdin and everybody else. But some of the early stories are like that, and I enjoyed it so much that I thought I would try it.
It kind of reminds me of the Inception, that movie that's up for an Oscar, you know, that's about dream within a dream within a dream.
Yeah.
So it was really an intriguing way to do this, I think. I'm really curious about, you said you read in Georgia. I'm curious about what kind of reaction you got there, because, you know, in a way this is somewhat critical of the history of the South. In, you know, it's pointing out some things that really weren't right about a lot of people, how a lot of people thought.
Right. So, well, that's true. Although, you know, Harper Lee pointed those things out already, and everybody loved that book.
That's
you
true.
Know, I mean, the it's not, you know.
No, you're certainly not the first one to do this, but
right. Well, and To Kill a Mockingbird comes to mind because there's also the young girl as the narrator. And in fact, I kind of deliberately did a few things with To Kill a Mockingbird in mind so that, you know, in To Kill a Mockingbird, Atticus Finch, the lawyer, Scout's father, is the hero of the story. The black man that he defends is really kind of presented as he's pretty much a victim. You know, I mean, he's an innocent man, but he's a victim. And it became, which is fair, it's not that that's inaccurate, but in this book, the lawyer, the only lawyer in town is the Grand Goblin of the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah, right.
And the smartest guy in town is the black character.
Yes.
So
yeah.
That was a kind of a deliberate reversal that, you know, I thought would a sort of both a tribute to and a response, you know, to Kill a Mockingbird. But you know, the main trouble Southern readers, pretty much all of the fan mail I get about the book is from Southern readers.
Really?
I've had so many people say that, oh, I just got it so right, and the relationship between the black kids and the white kids, you know, in this, when you're dealing with this official, you know, intractable segregation, and yet it's subverted in all these different ways through personal relationships, and yet it's always an obstacle in those personal relationships. So it was wonderful to hear from people how much they enjoyed the book. Booksellers in the South. There was one bookstore that's was recently featured in Southern Living magazine as one of the 5 best bookstores, you know, because they do the 5 best of everything in the South. And their must read book for the year was The Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia.
Ooh, wow!
Just a wonderful, you know, vote of confidence for it. But that said, when I went to read, in one reading, a woman came up to me and said, well, you know, I really loved your book, but when I picked it up and I saw you were from Iowa, I almost didn't read it.
I wondered about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because it's different than Harper Lee.
If there was any sticking point, it was that, you know, where's your Southern accent? You know, where are you from?
Right.
But again, I do have, as I say, I kind of... Half of my family is from the South, and they're a family that I'm you know, equally close to as I am to the northern half. So to me, at first, that was a big surprise, and then I thought, well, duh, you know, you should realize people are gonna say, oh, she's from Iowa. But apparently, you know, maybe there are some people who didn't read the book when they saw I was from Iowa. That's quite possible. I don't know.
Well, it's one thing for a southern writer to be telling stories of the South, and for a northern writer to tell those same stories. I think, that there's some.
People are going to take it differently. That may, in fact, as I say, have been a stumbling block for some people. But I was glad that the particular reader who mentioned it overcame the stumbling block, and so I guess I have to hope and presume that others did too, because as I say, it did get I did hear a lot from booksellers and readers in the South.
Well, I think when if they started to read it, they would see that the flavor of it and it's just, you know, it's just a great piece. It really is.
Well, Mary Helen, we only have a few minutes left. I want to ask you a little bit about how you found your publisher and what the process of getting published was like for you.
Oh, okay. Just interrupt me if you want to tell you the story. The publisher of The Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia is W.W. Norton, which is also the publisher of The Turk and My Mother. So it's really The Turk and My Mother who found the publisher.
Right.
And then I worked with the same editor there on The Caliphs. And how I found that publisher was I had written a novella, like a 75, I mean, it was a very long short story or a novella. It was a 75-page story that was called The Turk and My Mother. And I sent it out as I had been sending out stories. This would be in about in the early 2000s here. I would send work out to literary magazines. And that's what I had been doing for, you know, 15 years since I graduated, you know, from the workshop. So it was taken by a publisher, by a magazine called Epic at Cornell University, and they published The Turk and My Mother and just the 75-page novella. And then I heard from agents as a result.
Oh.
And one agent in particular was recommended to me by the editor of the literary journal. And that had happened before. In the previous 15 years when I was sending stories out, very often a story would appear in a magazine, whether a slick magazine or a literary journal kind of, you know, thing that just comes out a few times a year. And I would get I would get letters from agents from time to time saying, oh, do you have a novel? And my answer was always, ooh, not really, I'm writing short stories. Tell us when you have a novel. So really the editor of the magazine kind of put me in touch with the agent. And then the agent sent the book around. And in fact, there was a whole round. We sent it around before it was finished, actually, because I'm actually talking about The Turk and My Mother now that I think about it, not The Caliphs. But we sent it around, and it got rejected everywhere. And then I finished it, so we had the whole book. And then, I mean, it got rejected everywhere, but sometimes they would say, well, you know, send it back when it's finished, because maybe then we'll be interested. And then someone, Norton, bought it. Elaine Mason, my editor at Norton, just fell in love with The Turk and My Mother, and so they bought the book.
So had you always intended to expand the novella into a full-length novel, or was it because this agent encouraged you to do that?
Well, I had thought it would be a book of three novellas. That was what I had in mind. And, in fact, it kind of is a book of three novellas, but, you know, they call it a novel, so that... Yeah, I mean, I did do a little bit, because they were interrelated in any case. They were all about the same family. I mean, it's two brothers and one brother in this little Austro-Hungarian village, and one of them stays in the village and gets, you know, conscripted into the army of the Habsburgs and ends up a prisoner of war in Siberia, and the other one goes to Milwaukee, you know, and is an enemy alien during the war. So it's sort of following those two brothers and on either side of the globe, and... So it lent itself to be, it was obviously going to be related, but separate novellas. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up writing an epilogue and doing some other things that would tie it together just a little bit more. But I really think it really is three novellas plus an epilogue.
Interesting.
But it works.
Yeah, it does, because I never thought about that as I was reading it.
Good.
Yeah, it seemed coherent to me. So, well, in the minute or two we have left, Mary Helen, why don't you tell us what you're working on next?
What I'm working on next? I don't know. I think that's classified information.
Okay.
To some extent, I think that it is. I'm actually working on a number of things, and I'm not sure which one is going to be the next book. But one of them, I can tell you, involves baseball.
Wow. Really? Wow.
Wow.
I've gotten very interested in baseball.
No, there's a lot of culture in American
there
baseball.
There certainly is. Yeah. There's a lot of culture and not a lot of women.
That's right.
Interesting. Well, what advice would you give aspiring writers? I know you teach writing as well as being a writer yourself, so I'm sure you have some great parting words of wisdom for our listeners out there who want to be published writers.
Okay. Well, the first thing is what William Faulkner said, and that's read everything and ask yourself how they do it. So read a lot of the kind of things that you want to write. And I guess the other another thing would be to set yourself a writing time and write regularly, even if that's only once a week. But make it non-negotiable so that, you know, the muse is waiting for you when you sit down at that regular time to work. I think those are probably the two main things. And maybe the last thing is, first and foremost, you have to please yourself, because you're just always going to be running into rejection and to other opinions about what you should be doing. And forget about all that and write what pleases you.
No point spending your time writing somebody else's story. Yeah.
Well, right, unless you somehow made it your own in some way, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Mary Helen, and I hope that we hear from you soon with your next novel so we can have you back on Writer's Voices.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. I've been delighted to be here.
And I wanted this. She could have written this. I don't know who wrote this, but
we have a quote from Mom.
Yeah.
Here.
Better to write for self and have no public than to write for the public and have no self.
Oh, that's very good. I like
perfect.
That.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, perfect.
And that's the one that you just picked out for today, not even knowing.
Yep.
Oh, fantastic. Yep. See you next week on Writer's Voices. Stay tuned for James Moore, who's coming up next with Planet Erstwhile, if you're listening on Friday. And if you're listening on Monday morning, have a great week. See you.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.